Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today we're looking at roads in the 19th century. Now, the 19th century is not generally thought of as a period of roads. It's, after all, the period that is dominated in our discussion of transport by railway. And indeed, Graham and I have covered railway in a recent series. But just because something isn't at the forefront of news, it doesn't mean one shouldn't give it attention. Not least because, as I were going to try and show, there are interesting things you can say about 19th century roads. And indeed, 19th century roads are necessarily the background to their 20th century counterparts. So let's start off with a quote from the architect Gilbert Scott, noted, of course, for some great works in London. He recalled being told by his father Thomas, who lived from 1780 to 1835, about a place, a village called Gawcott, G-A-W-C-O-T-T, close to Buckingham, scarcely in the margins of the country. Quote, "He found the road to it rendered impassable by a large hole dug across it, in which the inhabitants were engaged in baiting a badger." Now, I mean, roads serve many purposes, but I don't think many at the present moment, despite the way in which there are many holes in them. Maybe you could say that potholes are designed as a way to actually encourage the locals now to deal with badgers. But anyway, it serves as a reminder that the age of the turnpike and the age that followed the turnpike, or where in which the turnpikes were still there, but not with massive numbers of new ones, was nevertheless an age which was very varied. And as a reminder of varied purposes, in the early 19th century, the Royal Military Canal was dug along the inner edge of Romney Marsh as a preparation to resist Napoleonic invasion. Canals, like roads, could serve a whole host of purposes. Now, in the case of roads, in the early 19th century, it was the case that the turnpikes of the 18th century were still largely in position. After all, it was the same as in the later Roman Empire or the later medieval period, that there already had been road building. But it doesn't mean that there weren't insignificant small-scale changes. These included the straightening and draining of roads and the strengthening of foundations, all of which were important in improving the system. Incidentally, a reminder in a different context, and with the analogy being only so useful, that it would probably have been better in the case of modern British railways to have improved existing railways rather than to have engaged in folies de grandeur such as HST2. Now, if you take my county of Devon, turnpikes were constructed, for example, from Yard to near Ilminster in 1807-12 and from Broadcliffe to near Columpton in 1813-16. There were also improvements to the existing roads. In the 1820s and early 1830s, for example, the worst routes of the Exeter Turnpike Trust, which was the major turnpike trust for East Devon, were replaced. All these small developments led to smoother and more level roads and thus to an ability to pull heavier loads. Indeed, at the national level, by 1830, about 1,000 horse-drawn goods wagons left or entered London weekly, and some could carry loads of 6 tons. Now, it was to be many years before the rail system could match that. The widening of Devon roads in the 1820s had helped in the replacement of pack horses by wheeled traffic, while that decade the turnpike through the Snake Pass from Glossop to Sheffield helped open up the Northern Peak District. By then, as an example of greater speeds, London mail coaches could reach Manchester in one day, and up to 13 coaches daily went between Leeds and Manchester. More generally, many roads were improved by resurfacing. So if you take John McAdam, Scottish born, 1756 to 1836, who is an example of the Britishness of that period, he was general surveyor of the roads for the Bristol Turnpike Trust, one of the most important in England, from 1815 until his death, experimented with consolidating a layer of small broken hard stone to form a very hard surface. Unlike Thomas Telford, who emphasised stronger foundations, macadamised and cambered roads gave a harder and drier road surface, and this permitted greater speed. Macadam's system was important because it was simple and relatively inexpensive, and that helped to encourage it to spread. So again, into my part of the world, the Exeter to Exmouth Turnpike had that was the road was macadamised in 1819. His family were surveyors to almost 150 turnpike trusts by 1861. And if you're thinking that's macadam, the later use of tar, in large part in response to cars, the dust they caused in their tyres, was to lead to the term tarmac. So that's how you get macadam leading into tarmac. On the same time, again, one has to be aware there were deficiencies. For example, I've noted that the Wirral in Cheshire didn't get most of its turnpikes until after 1820, while the Taunton Courier, in the issue of the 13th of February 1823, criticised the Taunton Turnpike Trust for the state of the road between Taunton and Langport. It was damp then, it was damp in the 18th century, it is still damp today. At the same time, it's necessary to remember that the social context continued to be problematic for roads, as was forcibly demonstrated in the widespread disturbances in West and Mid Wales in 1839 to 43, the so-called Rebecca Riots. These often involved attacks on toll gates, which were seen as a form of exaction, particularly in the late 1830s, when the toll renters greatly increased the number of side bars or toll gates on byroads that bypassed the main toll booths. These hit the farmers, not least the transport of lime for fertiliser. And the riots led to the Turnpike South Wales Act of 1844, which greatly cut the toll on lime movements, as well as consolidating the trusts. Now, I mentioned this point about the Rebecca riots because it's all too easy to just discuss transport in terms of technology, etc. One has to be aware that individual changes, improvements, if you like, might well be to many socially regressive. Moreover, criticism of roads has to address the issue of different requirements. Alongside those who wanted roads improved, or indeed wanted the contracts to build or to improve them, and therefore made a lot of noise about the need for improvement, there were others, notably drovers, for whom the roads were good enough. Furthermore, there were problems as far as not just the road surface was concerned, but also carriage traffic and horses. For example, en route from London to Oxford in 1806, John Lee, a traveller, noted, quote, having in this stage, that's the stage of horses, from Hounslow to Slough, two leaders very unequal to each other, their traces were observed to be crossed, and the coachman informed us that they were that by that means able to draw better together. I doubt it very much. He was right. And often one of the problems with horses and carriages, particularly if going at any speed, was that the horses were often unequal. Pressing on from Oxford to Worcester, he found the coach slower. Leaving Oxford at 7 in the morning, Lee didn't arrive in Worcester till 6:15 in the evening. Nevertheless, there were also improvements in bridging. The Bridges Act of 1803 provided a national regulatory framework by declaring that no bridge could be built and taken as a county bridge unless built under the direction of the county surveyor, a measure seen as ensuring adequate bridges. To be taken as a county bridge meant that if necessary, the county would be willing to provide financial support, but the county had to be satisfied with the standard. Individual bridges saw quite a variety. We tend to often focus on suspension bridges, and I'll refer to those in a second, but there were also non-suspension bridges over, for example, the estuaries of the Teme and the Plym in South Devon, opened in 1827, which made most of South Devon accessible to road traffic, which it really hadn't been before. Steam and chain floating bridges, and you can still see in Dartmouth there is still a chain bridge, followed at Dartmouth, at Saltash, and at Tor Point. Such improvements served to integrate regions into the national economy and to create demand for further such development. But in addition, there were technological change in bridges, and all of this, as I've said, nothing to do with the spread of railways. The Union Chain Bridge opened over the Tweed near Berwick in 1820 for the Berwick and North Durham Turnpike Trust, was the first British suspension bridge able to carry loaded carriages. Turnpike roads focused on these and other new crossing places, such as the suspension bridge across the River Tees at Walton, opened in 1831. The Conway Suspension Bridge, built by Thomas Telford and completed in 1826, replaced the ferry that had previously been the only means to cross the river. So that suspension bridge was more significant than anything that has come since at that particular point. It was part of an improvement to road transport that helped open up North Wales, ensuring that Holyhead became a more important port for Dublin, thus rivaling Liverpool. The opening of the Menai Suspension Bridge in 1826 contributed to bringing about the end of ferries between Anglesey and the mainland of Wales. Three of them went by the 1840s. There were also transport improvements in that part of the world to open up the slate mining district. And Telford, who was engineer as well to the Highland Roads Commissioners in Scotland from 1803 to 21, had built about 1,200 miles of well-drained new and or improved roads to the north and west of the Great Glen. Alongside stone bridges, there were now also iron ones. The first one at Coalbrookdale, which we've already mentioned, was heavy and had a modest span, but was followed by those that were lighter. And so often, one should focus not on the first development, but on those that were the subsequent ones. The second at Trentham, built in 1794, was less important than that at Buildwas in 1796, which was much lighter and wider than Coalbrookdale, establishing a pattern that could be followed. Nevertheless, the cause of suspension bridges was put back in 1830 when the newly completed one over the South Esk at Montrose in Scotland partially collapsed when 70 spectators rushed from one side to another during a boat race. As a result, the proposal to build a similar structure across the Tamar was abandoned. But nevertheless, suspension bridges continued to be built. The design submitted in 1831 by Isambard Kingdom Brunel for a suspension bridge over the Avon at Clifton near Bristol was accepted as the most mathematically exact of those tendered. Brunel was appointed engineer. Work began in 1836. It remained unfinished in his lifetime due to a lack of funds, but the bridge was eventually completed in 1864, according to his plans. Far more than trial and error was involved. There was science and the application of science. Thus, for example, for Telford's Britannia Bridge over the River Conway, which I've already mentioned, that a tubular form was used in order to provide stability. The carefully worked out designs were tested by experiment, including the construction of a scale model that was tested with weights. Furthermore, steam power was an important aspect of the construction of bridges. For example, with the high-level bridge over the Tyne at Newcastle, still a very impressive bridge, steam hammers were employed for driving the foundations into the riverbed. So what one's got in the early 19th century and the background to rail is still an impressive amount of road building. Nevertheless, as we discussed in our series on rail comes through and very much takes the agenda from the 1830s, a process that is helped not just by a sense of novelty, but also by the degree to which there is enormous willingness to invest in rail. And indeed, in some respect, one of the things that hits road is that road investment patterns are saturated. There are not new vehicles encouraging interest in road investment as there is in rail investment, and as a result of which, road becomes somewhat subordinate. Indeed, one of the major drivers of road transport in the later decades of the century, the 19th century, focused on the requirements for rail, both for rail, both, the road, in other words, helping rail, both for freight and for passengers. You can see that, for example, in the development of an important use of road transport in cities, which is that of omnibuses. In 1829, George Shillabeer had introduced to London the Paris system of omnibuses. He ran two from Paddington along the New Road to the Bank of England, and in each, 29 passengers could be carried at a fare of 1 shilling. In 1834, Shillabeer established services to Greenwich and Woolwich. He himself was ruined by railway competition, and as you may know, the late 1830s saw the important line actually pushed through to Greenwich. Railway competition was much better capitalised, but in 1856, the London General Omnibus Company was founded, and horse-drawn buses became a key element, not least linking the railway termini. In turn, trams, which were horse-drawn buses operating on rails that were put on top of roads, the road, in other words, being, as it were, the rail bed, appeared in London in 1869, and by 1874, over 60 miles of track had been laid there. In the 1880s, horse-drawn omnibuses were largely replaced by trams, which from the 1890s were electrified. So, in other words, what one has to do is note the degree to which road is sort of fitting in with rail. And this is, in a sense, to be a help to ensure that whilst rail is to the fore and rail is, as it were, a private enterprise system, the public enterprise system, which was potentially there if county councils were to replace turnpike trusts, were secondary. And I think, as I've said, it's important to remember these potential contrasts. Now, if you go into the late 1890s, there are other forms of technology that are coming forward. But at the same time, some of the road system is being stressed by the expansion of rail. Rail's technology is already there, it's expansion. So, again, if you think about my part of the world, some of the turnpikes are bankrupted. For example, in nearby Dorset, the Wimborne to Puddletown turnpike was hit by the introduction of the Southampton and Dorchester Railway. At the same time, there were improvements to the existing road network, including new bridges. For example, at Evesham, the Workman Bridge was built over the River Avon in 1866. Furthermore, the establishment of county councils in 1889 was accompanied by the winding up of turnpike trusts. Prior to that, the trusts had been overseen by Parliament, to which annual accounts were submitted, and by the County Quarter Sessions, which oversaw the parishes. But now the situation had the potential, if counties were willing to spend the money, to be much more active. At the same time, as trusts went bankrupt, if county councils were not to spend the money, the danger is that their road system would atrophy. As mentioned, there were new technology also as far as roads. Now, we tend to focus on the car, but actually, for most people in the 1890s, the new technology that was of note was not the car, but more the bicycle. The demand for bikes had grown greatly as a result of the introduction of safety bikes in the 1880s and of the comfort and maintenance resulting from the invention of pneumatic tyres. The 1890s saw a boom in cycling, with individuals, including young women, free to wander freely and flexibly. The press runs of Bartholomew's cycling maps rose from 2,000 in the early 1890s to 60,000 by 1908. Cyclists tend to be noted most, of course, for cycling off into the countryside, but there was also a lot of cycling in town, and the pressures of urban transport were captured by writers. Of the lower middle class, George and Weedon Grossmith observed in the Diary of a Nobody in 1892 that the Pooters rented a house in Holloway rather too close to the railway line, which is cheap because of the noise. But it wasn't only that the trains that made a noise. In his The Third Generation, Arthur Conan Doyle, 1894, that is, referred to, quote, the dull roar of the traffic which converged all day upon London Bridge. Following in the story of the sealed room in 1898, with a four-wheeled cab, that opprobrium of London was coming jolting and creaking in one direction, while in the other there was a yellow glare from the lamp of a cyclist. The following year, 1899, Sir John Barry estimated that eight horse-drawn buses a minute would pass an observer on Tottenham Court Road, an intensity that posed the problem of disposing of manure. Indeed, the more general removal of waste was an essential part of urban transport, one made more necessary by the rapid growth of the population. So I think one also has to note that although it was possible to envisage in 1899 London suffocating under the fumes of manure, there were, in practical terms, the tram systems, which were offering a cross between roads and rail, that actually were carrying more passengers. They cost, the electric trams cost more, carried more passengers than horse trams and were quicker, and they cost less than the motor buses. London, indeed, by 1913 had 1,000 motor buses, the first of which had been introduced in 1905. Gives you an idea of how fast they could introduce new systems in that period. The pressure of transport in city streets meant that they essentially became means for circulation rather than for sociability, household tasks, leisure, manufacturing, trade, and shopping. People were subordinated to this outside purpose, with the utilitarianism of improved traffic taking precedence over other goals. At the same time, horse-drawn wagons continued to be important in urban areas as well as their rural counterparts. Already in 1886, Parliament had repealed the legislation that had obliged cars to follow a man carrying a red flag and instead allowed them to drive at up to 14 miles an hour. Not too different from the speed of transport, of course, in modern London on the roads, but the context was somewhat different. The Motor Car Act of 1903 extended the rights of the motorist, but also introduced car registration, a very unpopular step. That for heavy road vehicles had been introduced with the Highways and Locomotives Act of 1878. Now, the imaginative impact of transport in the late 19th century was, and is today, for that period, very much focused on rail. This, however, downplayed the extent to which these other forms of transport, road transport, were very important, including walking. One of the things you could not do was walk along a railway line. Even if you wanted to, the nature of cuttings and embankments made that largely impossible. But roads, of course, ensured walking spaces, however hazardous they might be. And the significance of this walking emerges clearly in the autobiographies that survive, that deal with the poor, and indeed in a number of novels dealing with the poor. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that the combination of walking, cycling, and road vehicles has to be taken account when one looks at the period. And you can see this more generally in all sorts of sources, and you can see it in photographs from the period, which are an instructive guide to what was present on the roads of the period. But let me take an example as my close on the 19th century with a novel that appeared shortly before the close, Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, which was published in 1897. Now, as you are aware, if you've read the novel, and if you haven't, you should. It's an interesting novel which deals with an enormous amount. And it's not just set in Transylvania, a lot of it is set in Britain. As an instance of variety, Stoker refers to, quote, a little crowd of cyclists and others who were genially noisy at a Hampstead pub. Quote, he refers to a patrol of horse police going their usual suburban round. Quote, he refers to a four-wheeler cab in London. He refers to carts, horse-drawn carts, moving Dracula's boxes, a convenient way, of course, to move his body around London, as well as Dracula owning a Bradshaw in order to help him navigate the railway system. So rail, in other words, was part of a system that included roads, and roads were part of a system that included rail. Now, what I suggest now is we take one or two points because we'll press on next week with the 20th century. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I mean, you've covered a lot in this episode, starting from a period of horse-drawn carriages and carts, and ending through bicycles through onto cars. But I want to particularly focus on the relationship between railways and roads during this period, if I may. You mentioned, I thought very interesting, an experience in London where rails were simply laid on top of existing roads. How often was that done more broadly around the countryside? And often are we seeing railways navigating routes which are far removed from well-used roads, or are they adopting the same line of roads and almost running up along next to them?
Oh, well, that's an excellent question. First of all, railways often did follow different routes. I mean, because not least, they could be blasted through hills. I mean, and embank cuttings used. One of the significant things in the late 19th century is the improved explosives used in tunnel blasting. I mean, gunpowder had been used in tunnel blasting, of course, in the previous century. A man with a pickaxe would sort of knock a bit of a hole in a rock. You would then put some gunpowder in, and you would try and blow it, but it wouldn't. It's a slow work. Nitroglycerin and dynamite really changed the system. So railways have the capacity to very much follow different routes. There is also, with the use of embankments linked to bridges across rivers, there are the crossing of waterways lower down than had been done by road. So, for example, across the Tamar. Now, I think it all there. The difference is that it's the railway replacing the ferry. So it's not so much that there hasn't been the route in existence. It's just the route has been differently served. As far as light railways are concerned, there is an overlap, of course. I discuss it in my history of railways. There is an overlap between what you might call urban trams and rural light railways. And rural light railways require far less in by way of foundations, and can therefore be laid across what is the effect, can be a pre-existing roadbed, or indeed can be, and was sometimes done, the towpath of a canal.
Well, the 19th century is obviously a period of massive financial investment in railways. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of the 1840s, the railway mania and the crash and so on. To what extent did the mania for building railways draw capital investment away from the roads towards railways? Is there much evidence of new road laying drying up in the middle years of the 19th century because all the money was going into the newfangled railways? Or actually, were the railways, helping to urbanize Britain, which in turn was increasing the population, which in turn was requiring more roads? So, were they complementary, or was one surviving at the peril of the other?
Well, there was one area in which they were very complementary, and that was the massive expansion of towns and cities, in which the railways would often provide suburban services, which then helped to kickstart road building in that area. So that area, there is what you, and then of course the roads would take people to the railway stations. So there is a synergy there. I think it's fair to say your point is absolutely correct that there is not, as it were, new national trunk roads going in. I think you're absolutely correct. And I think there is pressure on the liquidity of turnpike trusts, but also that you could argue that it's a saturated system.
Yeah, and so when the Turnpike Trusts are wound up in the 1880s, that's a direct consequence of the fact that the money's not there for them anymore, and they've outlived their usefulness. Or is it they were only wound up because local government then took over direct role in creating roads, and so was the Turnpike's downfall a consequence of railway competition? Or was it purely an administrative decision that shifted power regardless?
Well, I think that's both. I mean, if you think about it, we still have the equivalent of turnpikes on some of the major tunnels and bridges, and they're perfectly usable. I mean, in other words, financially viable. In fact, they provide money for the agencies running them. So I would say that you get a combination of problems for individual trusts, weaknesses in the system as a whole, an ambition on the part of new county councils, a sense, a desire for change, often without due thinking about the obligations being taken on by ratepayers, and the problems in parts of the country of the Great Agricultural Depression and the difficulties that this caused.
And a final question, a technical question about the roads. So you talked about macadam and the tarmacadaming of roads. With the arrival of motor cars at the end of the 19th century, how good was the tarmacadam? Could these new fangled cars drive well on them, or did this require them to be resurfaced? Was tarmac
Oh, yeah,
improved?
cars were less of a problem than vehicles carrying freight.
Right,
It's
right.
the load that's the problem, and it's the development of lorries and omnibuses that is more significant than those of cars.
Well, we will move on to the age of heavier road freight and mass car ownership in the next episode. But for talking us through the 19th century history of roads in Britain, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.